Agatha Christie's The Lamp.
Number 19 was an old house. The venerable square that it shared with no less aged neighbours dated back to the building of nearby Weyminster Cathedral, and yet it wore its age with a sort of disapproving dignity. Austere and forbidding of countenance, it was greyer than grey, haughty and somehow aloof. In any other place, given that it had been unoccupied for many years, it would have been freely referred to by the locals as a haunted house. But in Weyminster, that would have been thought inappropriate. Only stately homes, manor houses and the like could possibly be visited by spectral phantasms. Ghosts were not for the middle classes. It just wouldn't be respectable. But number 19 remained empty. For sale or to let. Imagine Mr. Radish's delight then, that's Mr. Radish of Radish and Foplow Estate Agents, when he was contacted by a Mrs. Lancaster regarding the rental of the property. A viewing was suitably arranged, and Mr. Radish could barely contain his excitement at the possibility of finally removing the property from the company's books.
As you can see, Mrs. Lancaster, this is a property of some distinction. The large mullioned windows to the front of the house provide both character and, being south-facing, lots of light for both the dining room and the master bedroom above. I'll just open up, and I can assure you that the entrance hall is no less impressive.
How long has this property been empty?
Some time.
So I should think. Please go on.
And so they moved from room to room, from attic to cellar, Mr. Radish recovering his voluble self as he described each feature, while Mrs. Lancaster occasionally interrupted with pertinent questions. At last, they arrived back in a room on the ground floor, overlooking the square at the front of the house. Mrs. Lancaster briefly looked out through the windows, then turned on Mr. Radish.
What is the matter with the house?
Well, nothing, really. Any property that's been left unoccupied for a while does tend to feel a little gloomy.
Nonsense. The rent you are asking for this house is ridiculously low, purely nominal. And there must be some reason for it. Is the house haunted?
Mr. Radish, feeling more than a little like a schoolboy caught for some misdemeanor by a particularly strict housemaster, gave a nervous start, but said nothing.
Of course, it's all nonsense. I don't personally believe in ghosts or anything of that sort, and it's certainly no deterrent to me taking the house. But servants are unfortunately far more credulous and easily frightened. If you would be so kind, I'd like you to tell me exactly what sort of thing is supposed to haunt this place.
Well, I really don't know.
Come now, I'm sure you must. And I won't take the house unless I know. Then I believe we are done here. Good day to you.
Mrs. Lancaster!
So it is haunted?
Yes, so I'm told.
And?
Well, I don't know all the details, and there are a number of different versions of the story.
Mr. Radish!
It all goes back about 30 years or so, long before my time. A gentleman by the name of Williams rented out the house here. He was new to the area and didn't know anyone. He had no wife, no servants, no friends that anyone knew of, and kept himself to himself. He was rarely seen abroad during the day, but he did have a child, a young boy. One day, Williams apparently travelled up to London on his own. There, he was recognised by the police as being wanted for some crime. No one seems to know what it was, but it must have been serious.
Why do you say that?
Williams shot himself rather than give himself up.
Good heavens! What happened to the child?
He waited for his father to return. There must have been a little food in the house, so at first everything remained well. But as the days passed and Williams failed to appear, the boy became desperate. But this same father had impressed upon him that under no condition should he leave the house or speak to anyone. And despite his circumstances, this weak, ailing boy would not defy his father.
So he died?
I'm afraid so. Starved to death. No one knew his plight. No one knew his father was gone. And the police didn't find out where Williams had been staying until too late. One or two of the neighbours said afterwards they thought they'd heard crying.
And so it's this child's ghost that supposedly haunts this house.
Well, I don't know whether haunts is quite the correct term. Nothing's ever been seen. Not seen. It's just that some people, only some people, mind, say that they hear a child crying still.
Well, Mr. Radish, I like this house very much, and I shall certainly get nothing else like it for the price. I shall think it over and let you know directly. Good day.
Ah, well, Mrs. Lancaster, let me walk you to your motor car. I'm sure that we can come to some arrangement.
And they did. Mrs. Lancaster agreed to pay a sum even less than the original price quoted, which was already quite cheap enough. And when she moved in, a simple arrangement of brightly coloured rugs, well-polished furniture and a vast array of knick-knacks quite dispelled the gloomy nature of the old house.
It really looks rather cheerful now, doesn't it, Papa?
Yes, indeed. No one would ever dream that it was haunted.
Oh, Father, please don't talk such nonsense.
Oh, my dear, I seem to recall that it was you that told me about it.
It was just something that nervous little estate agent said. I certainly put no credence in such tales. And please, don't mention it in front of Geoffrey. He has such a vivid imagination.
Of course. Are those footsteps?
I think it's just the rain.
Now, those are definitely footsteps. Have you escaped from your nurse again, Geoffrey?
I smelled the cake, Mama.
Jane, you can call off the search. Geoffrey's down here with us.
Here's your cake. And please use the fork. Well, how do you like your new home?
Lots. Pounds and pounds and pounds.
Geoffrey, wait until you've finished eating before you speak.
Sorry, Mama. But Jane says there's attics. Can I go at once and explore them? I think there'll be a secret door. Shane says there probably won't be, but I think she's wrong.
We'll see about exploring the attics tomorrow, Geoffrey. Why don't you get your building bricks and make a nice house or an engine or something?
I don't want to make an house.
That's house.
I don't want to make a house or a hengine either.
Come on, let's go to the kitchen and get your face and hands scrubbed. Otherwise you'll get jam and cream all over your bricks, no matter what you build. And please don't run everywhere. You know how that tires you out so.
Still raining then. Jane? Is that you upstairs? Jane?
That night, Mr. Winburne dreamed. He was walking through a city made of children's building bricks. But the bricks weren't brightly coloured things of yellow and red and green. They were all grey. And as he moved through the grey streets, under the grey sky and an even greyer sun, he began to see people. And then he realised there were no adults, just children. A host of children. And they began to converge on him.
Have you brought him?
Have you brought him?
I'm sorry?
Have you brought him?
Have you brought him?
Have you brought him?
No.
Have you brought him?
No.
Have you brought him? Have you brought him? Have you?
No. No, I haven't.
Mr. Winburne awoke, confused and not a little distressed. Then he realised he could still hear crying. Reaching to his bedside cabinet, he turned on the lamp. The crying stopped. The following morning, Mr. Winburne didn't tell his daughter of either the dream or its sequel, but he was certain that it was not simply his imagination at work. And in the days to come, he caught snatches of a child sobbing during the daytime too. Yes, the wind was howling in the chimneys, but this was a separate sound, distinct, unmistakable. Nor was he the only one to hear it. He overheard two of the maids in conversation, complaining that the nurse must have been mistreating young Geoffrey something rotten, and he was sobbing his little heart out just this morning. But then Geoffrey appeared at lunch. He was smiling and happy. Only his mother seemed unable to hear the mournful sounds. Then one day...
Mummy, can I play with that little boy?
What little boy, dear?
I don't know his name. I found him in the attic earlier. He was sitting on the floor crying. I tried to talk to him, but he ran away. And then, when I was playing in the nursery with my bricks, he appeared in the doorway. He was watching me build. I've got a big city now, spread out all over the floor. He looked lonely, so I asked him whether he wanted to help me. But he just looked sad, as if he wanted to play, but his mother had told him he couldn't or something. And then he went. I think he's shy, not like a big boy at all. I asked Jane who he was, and if I could play with him, but she told me I was being silly and making things up, that there was no boy, and that I shouldn't tell such naughty stories. I don't like Jane anymore.
But darling, Jane is quite right. There is no little boy in the house, only you.
But I saw him, I did so. Jane's wrong and so are you.
Geoffrey!
Oh, please let me play with him. He's so lonely and unhappy. I want to make him better.
Now, Geoffrey.
Shush. Geoffrey, that poor little boy is lonely. And maybe you can help him. Maybe you can make him better. But you must find out how by yourself. It's like a puzzle, but only you can solve it.
Is it because I'm a big boy now?
Yes, because you're a big grown-up boy now.
Thank you, Grandfather.
Father, why did you say that? You're just encouraging him to believe in nonsense.
My dear, Geoffrey has seen things that I can only hear. Perhaps if I were younger, closer to his age, I might see them too, but I can't. But Geoffrey does.
See things? Hear things? This is absurd. If this is really happening, Father, then why aren't I seeing anything, hearing anything?
Mrs. Lancaster's father said nothing, but smiled a curiously tired smile.
And why did you tell him that he could help this thing? Oh, this is all so impossible.
Why? A long time ago, I read a book called The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And amongst many other things that have stayed with me over the years, it contained this. What lamp has destiny to guide her little children, stumbling in the dark? A blind understanding, Heaven replied. And Geoffrey has that. A blind understanding. I think that possibly all children have it, but as we grow older, we lose it, leave it behind with our discarded toys. Sometimes, perhaps, as we move towards our twilight years, a glimmer of that insight returns. But the lamp burns at its brightest when we are young and the world is still so full of possibilities.
I don't understand.
Nor do I. Not fully. But I do know that somehow, trapped within this house, is a small, lonely child. It wants to be free. I don't think we can help it. But possibly Geoffrey can. And I think we should let him.
But Geoffrey, he's so weak. His constitution. It's why we moved away from London. This excitement, it can't be good for him.
I know Geoffrey's unwell. But would you rather he were all wrapped up in cotton wool, kept away from anything, everything that might possibly be a danger?
Yes. Yes, I would. I've already lost his father. I don't think I could stand losing him.
Then you are trapping him just as surely as Williams did his son.
How dare you, Father?
Do you think Williams thought that by telling his son not to speak to the neighbours, he'd be taking that child's life away? By keeping Geoffrey here, away from other children, away from the world, what life is he to have? Oh, he may live a little longer, but is it living, really? He's as much a prisoner here as that child in the attic.
It's not the same, not remotely. I love him. I'd do anything for him. You know that.
Then let him explore and discover. Let him bruise his knees and scrape his elbows. Let him live. for as long as he has.
Father,
Please.
All right. All right. Father, I'm scared.
So am I, my darling. So am I.
For that summer, the sun shone on Weyminster, and on the Cathedral Square in particular as it had never done before, or so it seemed. The large mullioned windows, as Mr. Radish had pointed out, allowed the light to fill number 19. Long-established shadows slid away, replaced by a honey-toned hue to the whole house. Geoffrey ran and played and laughed, and his mother and grandfather laughed too. He barked his shins playing ball with the children at number 5 and cut his head falling from a tree in the back garden. With his bandaged head, he became a wounded but valiant soldier, leading the charge against a vile enemy that looked a lot like Mary and George for a number 25. But he also spent time in the attic, as good as his word, trying to find out how to help the other little boy. Come the autumn, and a bitter east wind whipped along the cobblestones in front of the house. Geoffrey caught a chill and was put to bed. But despite his mother and his nurse's best ministrations, he got no better. The doctor from London was called.
Well, doctor?
I'm afraid he's very ill, Mrs. Lancaster.
What can be done? What can I do?
Make him comfortable. And make sure he has lots of fluids. Lemon barley water, that sort of thing. I've given a prescription to the nurse for something that should help with his temperature, but most of all, just be with him.
Thank you. I'll go to him now.
Is there any hope? Be straight with me now.
To be honest, very little. I've treated him since shortly after his birth, as you know, and Geoffrey's lung complaint was always likely to...
Kill him?
That's a little more brutal than I would have liked, but yes, it was unlikely he would have ever achieved maturity. I'm sorry, but there was nothing that anyone could have done.
Thank you. I'll see you out.
If you don't mind, can I ask you something?
Of course.
Is Geoffrey a happy child? Forgive me if that seems impertinent, but when a life is cut so short...
Yes. Yes, he is.
In the days that followed, as she nursed Geoffrey, Mrs. Lancaster became aware of the other child. She heard crying, at first just faintly, almost indistinguishable from the wind, but as time went on, they became more distinct. Eventually, she heard the heartbreaking sounds of a child sobbing, even in those rare moments of dead calm. Geoffrey grew worse, falling into a form of delirium. He called out to the other little boy again and again.
I will help you. I will.
Before falling back onto his pillow. There came a night, moonlit and still. Geoffrey lay there unmoving, breathing raggedly. His mother held his hand, as she always did on her nightly vigils. In the corner of the room sat his grandfather, a stalwart sentinel. Suddenly, Geoffrey stirred, and sitting up, looked across to the open doorway.
All right. I'm coming.
Joyful, contented laughter filled the room.
Father, I'm so frightened.
It's all right, my darling. It's all right.
There's two of them now. Yes. There's two.
Yes, there are. Geoffrey worked it out.
What?
The other little boy. Geoffrey's taking him with him. He's free, finally. Well done, my boy. My big, grown-up boy. Well done.
This has been a Theatre Workshop Causdon Atmospherics production of Agatha Christie's The Lamp, adapted to a radio play by Paul M. Ford from a short story first published in 1933. The part of the narrator was read by Mike Brown, Mr. Radish by Joe Wilson, Mrs. Lancaster by Dawn Ford, Mr. Winburne by Tim Young, Geoffrey Lancaster by Alfie Brown, The Doctor by Connor Nestor, and the voices of the children by Kira Ford.